Hi there, and welcome to New Books in South Asian Studies. I'm your host, Ian Cook, and today we're going to be talking about re-engineering India, work, capital, and class in an offshore economy. The book is written by Carol Lepadia and is published by Oxford University Press in 2016. Carol is a professor in the School of Social Sciences at the National Institute of Advanced Studies in Bengaluru. How is India's burgeoning IT industry reshaping the country? What types of capital is IT attracting, and what formations does it take? How are software engineers managed? What are their goals and aspirations? How are they perceived by their foreign clients? In her book, Carol tackles these questions and many more, drawing on extensive research in Bangalore, the large southern Indian metropolis that, of course, has led the IT buzz. And in doing so, the book explores the way capital, work, and class are remade within what is supposedly a new India. It combines deep, rich, and detailed accounts of life within what one informant calls software factories, with a theoretical eclecticism and a real clear writing style. And as such, I think the book is a truly wonderful anthropological account of an offshore economy. I had the pleasure of speaking with Carol just a few moments before. Okay, so it gives me great pleasure to welcome Carol to New Books in South Asian Studies. Let's dive straight into your book. So your book is about the IT industry and IT workers in Bangalore, sort of the metropolis in one of the two metropolises in South India. So to borrow from your book's title for my first question, I want to ask you, in what way is IT re-engineering India?
Well, first of all, thank you for inviting me to be on this podcast and to talk about my book. So that's a bit of a tough question because, in a sense, the whole book is about the idea that the IT industry has, in fact, had a very major economic and social impact on India's development. And so I guess, in a sense, the title is a bit tongue-in-cheek because my argument, as you'll see as we move along, is really that it's not really changing or transforming India in the way in which it is often claimed. But as a footnote to that, I just wanted to maybe tell a small story about the title, which is also quite revealing, which is that earlier the title I had for the book was something like Rebooting India or India Rebooted, because, of course, when we name books, we try to think of something clever and do some wordplay. But when my book was about to go to press, I suddenly opened one of my news portals one day and found that Nandan Nilekani, who is one of the main highly visible, well-known IT industry leaders in Bangalore, had just published a book with exactly the same title, India, Rebooting India. And of course, I'll come back to that maybe in a couple minutes, but the ways in which, of course, IT industry leaders represent the software industry and the ways in which academics look at it is quite different. So I immediately panicked and I contacted the publisher and said, we have to find a new name, and which is how we landed up with this one. But my point here is that it's very interesting how there is this kind of recursive cycle of knowledge and representation that that runs around the software industry in India, so that it's possible for an IT leader and an academic sociologist to you know, dream up the same title. And I think that tells you a lot about the symbolic importance of the industry in India, which is really one of the main arguments of the book.
Wonderful, that's great. And we're going to talk a lot about the book in depth, but before we get to the book itself, could you tell us first a little bit about yourself? What's your academic background and what brought you to researching this topic?
Okay, I'm an anthropologist by training, and my original field work, PhD research, was in India a long time ago. I had come to India from the US to do my dissertation research, which was in the southern Indian state of Andhra Pradesh. I was interested in the impact of the Green Revolution because this was like in the early 1980s, and it was kind of a hot topic in those days to talk about new technologies and agrarian change and the, you know, social impact of that. That is how I really started doing research in India. I've worked on a whole lot of different things. I would say broadly, most of my work has been around questions of the linkages between development, class, capital, social transformations, which I look at in various ways and through various kinds of field work. This particular book came out of a study of the software industry in Bangalore that I did along with my colleague A.R. Vasavi at the National Institute of Advanced Studies in Bangalore. And so, as I say in my acknowledgement, the whole project, the idea for the project was really hers, and I give her full credit for that. I had moved to Bangalore just prior to starting this work, and I wasn't very familiar with the context. But Vasavi grew up in Karnataka and partly in Bangalore, and she was, as a sociologist, very aware of these very rapid changes that were happening in the city because of the rise of the software industry. And we had met, and she told me, we really have to study this because there seems to be a whole new social category of people emerging around the industry, and so we should really do a study. And that's how the whole thing started.
Wonderful. That's great. Now let's start talking about some of the chapters themselves. And chapter one, you have a really fascinating discussion about capital, which is actually one of the concepts that you bring up in the subtitle of the book, and specifically something that you call software capital. So I was wondering, could you please tell us what software capital is and talk us through some of its different formations?
Okay. I'll try not to make it too long and complicated. The idea, well, I really derived this idea directly from a book by Kaushik Sundarajan called Biocapital, where he looks at the biotech industry in the U.S. as well as India. But the larger theoretical background is really a lot of discussions that have happened within anthropology over the years about the question of capital and capitalism itself, and whether, you know, there's like one capitalism which arises at a particular point in time in Western Europe and then, you know, spreads around the globe. Or are there multiple forms of it? Are there multiple capitalisms? And there's been some interesting work in India also in recent years looking at different forms of agrarian capitalism, different regional capitalisms. I mean, one can debate whether it makes sense to even talk about those different regional economies in terms of capitalism. That's a whole debate in itself. But what I was really trying to get at with this idea of software capital was to make another kind of argument, which is that a lot of both popular discussion and academic work on the Indian IT industry has represented it as something which is kind of an outgrowth of global capitalism, right? So because the developed Western economies have moved from industrial to post-industrial to more globalized formations, and there's a lot of offshoring and outsourcing of production and services, that somehow the Indian IT industry has grown up as a response to that. In other words, it's an effect of globalization. It's an effect of global capital. The work which I was doing on the software industry told me very quickly, but that's really not the whole story. So I wanted to emphasize, without getting into a kind of indigenous argument, I wanted to emphasize the local origins of this particular industry, and that was one kind of a point. And secondly was to look at capital and capitalism as something more than just an economic system, that it also, different kinds of capitalisms have particular or different cultural forms to them, right? There are different groups who become leading entrepreneurial or capitalist groups. It takes different kinds of shapes. And so on. And so by using this term, I was trying to think through the question of, well, what is it about the software industry in India, which can we use it as an example to talk about the differences which are there within capitalism? So within software capital, I delineated three different types, which I called national capital, multinational capital, and transnational capital. And I did that not just to be able to make distinctions between the different kinds of software companies which are there in Bangalore, which includes Indian, you know, homegrown Indian companies. It includes multinational companies which have set up their offshore centers in Bangalore. And it also includes small startup companies. And so these are three distinct kinds of organizations which have their own cultures and ways of organizing the production process. But to me, they also represented different different forms in the ways in which the Bangalore software industry links to its customers, clients, and head offices, you could say, in other places. So there, I was trying to be able to figure out a way to make those distinctions and not just talk about it in terms, in a kind of traditional way of, say, distinguishing between domestic and international capital, but to show that these different categories all had elements in them of the Indian, quote unquote, and the global. And this is also a theme that runs through the whole book, is trying to get away from those distinctions, because what you see when you really begin to look at the ways in which software companies are organized, or the ways in which the industry relates to other places, to its clients and so on, that there's always a mix between kind of locally oriented practices and structures and more transnationally oriented setups, one could say.
That's wonderful. I think if capital is one of the concepts in the subtitle of the book, another one is work. So let's talk a little bit about workers, because in chapters 2, 3, and 4 really looks at workers in quite some detail. And you have a nice quote in chapter 3 that comes from one of the software engineers, and he says, IT companies are factories. People go in and code goes out. So I was wondering, could you please tell us a little bit about the employment of IT workers? And if there's some specific way in which IT workers are managed?
Yeah, so this is really the question of labor and work and the IT workforce is really the core of the book. And that's why I've devoted really 3 chapters to that. Chapter 2 is about how the IT workforce has been assembled. So how are workers recruited? How are they trained? How are they then deployed? How do they find jobs and so on? And of course, I think your listeners will know that India does have a large IT workforce, although of course compared to the overall population and workforce is very small. There's still only around 3 million people, and yet it has provided a very a major avenue of employment for a lot of educated young people, primarily those who have done engineering degrees. So I was interested in that whole process through which young people get into engineering college and then get recruited to companies, and how they are then shaped into, in a sense, globally appropriate IT professionals, as they are called. So that's one part of it. But I should maybe back up for a minute and say that when Vasavi and I were conceptualizing the project, our idea really initially was not to look at the labor process, not to look at software organizations, we didn't have any questions about work in our minds. Our idea was really to kind of assemble a large sample. We were planning to interview around 500 software engineers and to really understand more about the changes in their lifestyle and their attitudes and that kind of thing, that, you know, thinking of them as a new segment of the so-called new middle class. But in order to contact that many people, we had to approach companies. We didn't know how else to get that cohort. And so we spent a lot of time contacting companies, you know, going and talking to HR managers, other kinds of managers, getting permission, you know, setting up interviews. And we did actually end up doing the survey, although it was never anywhere near the 500 sample that we wanted, since it was so difficult to get access. But because I kept going myself and other team members, we kept going to these companies, to these offices, trying to do these interviews. In the course of just hanging around in these workplaces for a lot of time, I became very interested in the question of work itself. So the project really started veering off in this other direction, which is why in the end I really was focusing on the nature of labor, the nature of these organizations, how actually the software development process works, what is the position of Indian outsourcing companies in this larger global value chain of IT services and software production. And then within that, I became interested in questions about the labor process and how actually that is being managed and controlled, right? So there's a whole lot of different things that I ended up looking at with this. And obviously, you know, even in traditional labor sociology, the question of you know, what makes workers work is very central. I mean, that is a major question of organizational theory also, is how do you extract value from the labor of workers? In this case, it's again a very complicated system. On the one hand, what you have is what has been called by others large software factories. And that is something which is not specific to India. It's something which you see across the world in the IT industry, where the production of software and software packages has become a kind of an assembly line process, which projects are broken up into small bits and divided among many individuals and teams. And it's possible to kind of work on it as an assembly line where, you know, different people do different bits of it and it gets put back together later. The whole outsourcing phenomenon began because then once that kind of a process had been established, it was possible to break it up and do different parts of it in different locations. And that is actually the basis of the whole IT outsourcing offshoring model, where they are able to use, for example, the entire 24 hours of the day by moving work from one site to another, as you know, across different time zones, and also dividing the work into different kinds of work according to the skills and capacities of different development centers. So that is why that comment came that, you know, it's like a factory and, you know, people go in and code go out. And there was a sense, I found that remark really interesting because it really encapsulated the ways in which I, as a sociologist, looked at the process. But of course, my understanding of that process came from the people we talked to, many of whom really felt that they were just really like that cogs in the wheel, that they're not doing very creative or interesting work, that they are just there to write code, and you know they're doing so within a very kind of routinized, rationalized work process and so on. So we documented a lot of both the process and the ways in which people responded to that. One of the reasons why that is the way in which software production is understood in India is because it's a fact that even today, what gets outsourced to companies in India by and large is what's called low end work. So within the whole software production cycle, there is, you know, kind of more so called high end creative, difficult work, which is done by software architects and people like that. And then there's the very routine, boring work of coding, code checking, software testing, etc., which frankly can be done by anyone with some amount of training. It's not a highly skilled work. So there is this kind of dissatisfaction that runs through a lot of the IT workforce that, you know, they're not really doing very challenging work, and it's kind of this very routinized factory dead-end kind of a job. But at the contradiction here is that at the same time, these people are highly paid compared to anyone else in a similar kind of a job in India. And so because they're well paid and because they're working in these kind of globalized high-tech workspaces, they, you know, the job itself has acquired a certain kind of a social prestige, which doesn't really accord with the nature of the work. And that's one of the contradictions I also try to look at when in the chapter on class formation. But just to go back to the question of the work process, so on the one hand, you have this kind of super rationalized, mechanistic work cycle that they're stuck in. On the other hand, what struck me and which took me a long time to puzzle through when I was trying to figure out how this whole thing works, is that when you talk to HR managers, you talk to people in the industry, they always say, oh, we have very, flexible, open-ended, non-hierarchical, flat organizations. We don't, we don't force people to work in a particular way. It's all very open and free. And because we have this kind of a very flexible work culture, we're very different from other kinds of organizations in India. And I kept hearing this, and in the beginning, I probably thought, well, that's interesting, and I just took it at face value. And the fact is that when I started digging into it, of course, there is a lot in the ways in which software organizations are managed, which does derive from what's been called the new management ideology of soft capitalism in the West, which is all about not managing workers from top down, but letting them, you know, in a sense, training them to become self-managing entrepreneurial workers, that, you know, you should take ownership of your work, then you should be proactive, and then you should be responsible for completing your work without having, you know, a manager breathing down your neck. That is the kind of new management mantra, new so-called new age management, which is very popular in the West, and which has now come into India mainly through the software industry. So what I've tried to do in the book is to understand how these two systems have been married together. How can you have this really highly structured factory type of software production process where engineers are made to really, I mean, they're really very closely monitored, and every unit of effort and every unit of time and every, you know, line of code is being constantly measured, counted, and assessed, you know, just like in the old Fordist factory. And on the other hand, they're all the time being told that, oh, you're an autonomous worker and, you know, you can manage your own workflow and things like that. So those two chapters, 3 and 4, are really about these organizational systems through which labor is managed, through which value is extracted from the work of software engineers.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. And I should mention that not just this one quote that I happened to pull out, it's actually lots of lots of really interesting quotes from the IT workers, and it's really nice that the book makes use of the book length format to really include like long extracts from the interviews, and they're very articulate and very reflexive about their position. This is, and some of them very witty and sardonic as well, which is really nice. So we just touched a little bit about the sort of the global nature of the process, and this also involves Indian IT workers coming into contact a lot with foreign clients, either abroad or sometimes also in India. So I was wondering, how are Indian techies, as they're called, how are they perceived by those outside India? And do the companies do anything to prepare the Indian workers for when they go outside or for when they meet foreign clients?
Yeah, so that question is very important, because I think one of the key arguments I tried to make in the book is that in this kind of a you know, transnational work setup where teams of Indian engineers sitting in India or Bangalore are working really in real time with clients or colleagues or other teams located in other places like in Europe or the US, one of the main problems, what is posed as a problem by managers, is the problem of culture and cultural difference. And I was really struck when I started spending time in these organizations to the extent to which talk about culture was always present. And as an anthropologist, of course, my ears perked up. I was very interested in this: how are people talking about culture, and what are they doing with this talk? So one of the things that we did in the study, which I didn't mention earlier, which is really important, apart from interviewing people and kind of hanging around in these places as much as we could, we observed a lot of training programs. And this was the site that I found the most, in a sense, ethnographic site of this whole project. The fact that these young software engineers are put through a lot of training programs. Some of the training, of course, is technical. It's about the work they have to do, and we didn't really bother much with those because I wouldn't have been able to follow anything. But I was very interested in what is called soft skills training. And as many listeners would know, soft skills is like, again, this big mantra in management, contemporary management thinking in the U.S. and other countries. And it's really all about this idea that the employee, whether that person is, you know, working in a very high-level job, like as an architect or even as a doctor, say, or in a low-level, say, you know, a shop service kind of a job, that what you really need to perform your work these days is soft skills like your demeanor, the way in which you present yourself, communication skills, the way in which you talk to the customer. These are all things which are seen as very crucial to the production of value. So in the case of the Indian software industry, a lot of the soft skills training that was done was communication skills, because there was this perception that Indian software engineers are very good at their technical stuff. They're really good at learning new technologies and doing coding and doing whatever they have to do, but they're very poor in communication. And we heard this all the time. Again, my ears perked up. What does it mean when they're saying, does it mean that there's a language barrier? Does it mean that there's some, you know, different cultural communication style, which is creating a problem when they talk to the Americans or the Brits? We observed quite a few of these training programs and also talked to various people about this. And what it really came down to cut a long story short, is the argument I began to think about was that the trope of culture becomes a mechanism through which workers are managed in these kind of cross-cultural or transnational work situations. So what I saw, and we had the opportunity, and we had several. I have several case studies in the book where I could talk to team members in India, team members abroad, managers, say foreign managers in other places, and I could talk to various people within these so-called virtual teams. And what you would get, not surprisingly, is a very different story from people sitting in different positions about a problem that occurred or a crisis which they had in the project. And when there was a problem, it was always blamed on culture, you know. And in a sense, the managers and the software engineers were being taught to think this way because it is being presented to them by soft skills trainers as a way in which to understand and work through problems. So if for example, I'm a British manager and you're my Indian software engineer, and I tell you this has to be done by this time, and you say, yeah, I'll do it, but ultimately you don't do it, right? So then what you're told is, well, this is an Indian cultural trait that, you know, it's very impolite to say no. So they always say yes, even if they know they can't finish the job. And then the next part of the training is about teaching people how to overcome, or to, you know, by understanding the cultural difference, you can then learn how to communicate better. So all of that kind of discourse became really fascinating to me, because it's not just about learning, teaching people how to work in a multicultural work environment. It's really about creating new kinds of subjects. It's about making people think about themselves in new ways, because now Indian IT professionals are being trained to think about themselves as Indians in a way in which they probably never have done. Not that they don't think about Indian culture, but the way in which the culture is being presented to them is very odd. And in fact, some of the dialogues we had with people were really interesting, where people would actually challenge the training person, you know, who would say, oh, Indian culture is like this, and, you know, French culture is like that. And they would say, you know, what are you talking about? This makes no sense. But nonetheless, I think it's the circulation of ideas about culture which really weaves together a lot of the work experiences that people have. Because even if, although most software engineers do have a chance to go and work abroad for some period of time, and they travel a lot, even when they're sitting in Bangalore, they're also all the time connected to colleagues and managers and teams and other places. And so that kind of an environment is not really creating what, you know, the older theories of globalization would tell you, which is about creating a kind of a new, you know, whatever, cosmopolitan or global culture within corporations. It's really creating a lot of difference, but in a very structured and a very odd kind of a way. So I was interested in how then software engineers absorb these ideas of cultural difference, as well as how do they absorb and engage with the other kinds of soft skills that they are taught, say communication or time management. Because what that kind of soft skills training is doing is also teaching you how to be a particular kind of a person. And it's telling you that, you know, if you can become this kind of a person, not only can you manage your work better, you can manage your life better. So the question that arises then is this something that actually does shape the subjectivities or the identities of these employees, or is it something that just rides on the surface, that they, you know, conform to certain expectations at work, but at home they're you know, remain something else? And by the way, this kind of question, you know, is something which is not new in Indian sociology. Way back in the 60s, when people were looking at the new industries, there was a lot of discussion of, you know, tradition and modernity. Does working in a modern industry change the social profile or personality of workers in a fundamental way, or do they make a split between their Indian culture and the modern workplace? In a sense, you know, these ideas are still there, but they're being reinvented through this kind of through the articulations of trainers and managers and all kinds of people within the industry itself.
Thank you. I think maybe my favorite ethnographic vignettes from the book are those during the training session. I think there's somebody you call Megan who has some very interesting opinions and very interesting conversations with the people she's trying to train. So the final big concept we need to talk about, sort of been drifting around in the background and now we should address it, is that of class. Now, when I suppose it's a paradox, because every time I meet an Indian techie, they're usually elite and they're usually high caste Brahmin. I mean, at the same time, it's the IT industry is held up as being this sort of great great vehicle for social mobility in India. So which is it? Is it a vehicle for social mobility, or is it just, you know, social reproduction? The same elite Brahmins filling up the best jobs in the country.
That's a good question, and I don't think it really can be answered by anyone, you know, mainly because we don't really have the data. I mean, we tried, and other researchers have tried very hard to get data from software companies that would really give us the social background of all these employees, so we could very easily tell, like, you know, what do they come from, the middle class or elite? Are they high caste, etc.? The only kind of data they ever gave us was gender breakdown. So we tried to extrapolate a little bit of information from the small survey we did and from other studies which are out there. And our finding showed exactly the same thing, what everyone seems to believe, although software companies like to deny it, which is that vast majority are from the upper caste. They do come from middle class background. And by middle class, we defined it in terms of having parents who were also educated and working in middle class jobs. And so that means they already had a certain kind of cultural capital, educational background, which enabled them to get into these jobs and into this industry. And so early on, very soon after the project was finished, I wrote a paper in which I made this argument very strongly. And I basically said that the IT industry is not really bringing about any kind of new opportunities or social mobility for people from other classes. It's really just middle class reproducing itself, et cetera, et cetera. And I make that argument also to some extent in the book. But I think when I started looking at my material more closely and also doing a bit more work after that particular project was over, especially where I'm working now in coastal Andhra, which is one of the main regions of India which has produced a lot of software engineers, here one does find different pathways. And it is those pathways of mobility that I find very interesting now to think about. So even though the majority of people are probably from urban, middle-class, educated families, and because, you know, and they were able to then use that background to get into good engineering colleges and from there get into decent IT jobs, there's another pathway through which people from rural areas, people from small towns, people who maybe didn't have English medium education, but, you know, and so are not very comfortable with English, but were able to get into engineering college and from there into these jobs. For them, it is a pathway of mobility, not necessarily in terms of economic mobility, because they may come from families who are well off. They may be, you know, landowning families in the rural setup who have plenty of money, but what they are lacking is the cultural capital of the middle class, right? But they are able to get into into the IT industry because of the engineering background. And in fact, what one finds when I started really taking apart my data more closely was that even within the IT workforce, there is a segmentation. And so at the very bottom of the heap, the kind of routine, ordinary coders, what they call them, who can do technical work but are not good at so-called client-facing roles because their English is not good enough or their, you know, whole cultural style is somehow not sufficiently cosmopolitan. But they are very good for these other kinds of jobs. And so you find a segment of the industry of people who have that background. And then there's a whole other segment of people who are kind of from ordinary middle class families who can maybe at the next level. And at the highest level, very strikingly, every single person we interviewed who was like a CEO or some other very top executive all these people were from the IITs, which are the Indian Institute of Technology, which are the premier engineering colleges, institutions in India, which produces the, you know, cream of people with an engineering background, majority of whom go to the U.S. and get good jobs. Very often they have been to the U.S. where they built a career, and now they've been cycled back to India to head the Indian operations of some company. So the stratification in the workforce also, in a sense, reflects class stratification. But I just want to say that of course, class structure in India is a highly complicated question. We can't just say that, you know, there are these classes A, B, C, D, E, because obviously, you know, it's hard to link up the different criteria. So as I mentioned, there could be people from kind of provincial places who are wealthier in terms of absolute money or property than an ordinary middle-class urban family. And yet, what they are lacking is the cultural capital of the middle class. And this is why I spend a lot of time in that sixth chapter talking about the middle class, because, and many other people have talked about the middle class in India, the new middle class, which has supposedly emerged after liberalization and so on. But I think it's an important category, because I think by looking at the middle class, we can really understand dimensions of power and the reproduction of inequality in the Indian context, which does not simply have to do with more structuralist approaches to class, which have to do with capital and labor and property, etc. Because in India, it's really other kinds of capital that you need to make it to mobilize yourself or to kind of maintain a particular social status in the society. So it is that, it is the idea of the middle class that I try to unpack in relation to the IT industry and the ways in which it has brought about some kinds of changes in the Indian context.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. I'm going to conclude our discussion about the book now. I hope everyone who's been listening has got a lot out of it. I think there's lots of people not only interested in South Asia, but also the anthropology of the sociology of work, globalization, and also, of course, of capital as well. So I hope lots of people check out the book. But usually on these podcasts, we ask our authors, now that this book is out, what are your, you know, current and future projects that you're working on?
Oh, well, as I mentioned, I have been doing some work in Andhra Pradesh, which is a southern Indian state, for the last 2 or 3 years, starting with a project that we had that we called Provincial Globalization, which was looking at migration and transnational ties in regional towns. So for that, I started going to a regional town called Vijayawada, and that's where I got back in touch with some of the villages there, where this is a region that has a very high rate of out-migration, primarily through the IT route. A lot of software engineers have come out of engineering colleges in that region and have landed up either in places like Bangalore or Hyderabad or even in the U.S. So it was very striking that if you go to even to the villages there, you know, a lot of the families you meet, at least those who have some amount of land and capital, they all have kids who are sitting in the U.S. or sitting in Bangalore. So that's why I became, again, interested in this question of mobility, that there is a lot of mobility happening. It's just that we're not really sure exactly how to map it. Mm-hmm. And, of course, for all, you know, number of people who are able to acquire some education or some a good IT job and get mobilized, there are a whole lot of people who are also left behind. So I've been doing some work on this question of mobility and immobility and its relation to different forms of inequality. And I'm also interested in the question of urban development. So right now I've been last couple of years I've been looking at the development of a new capital city in Andhra Pradesh, which is called Amaravati, and I've been looking at the ways in which that city is being imagined and built. What does it tell us about the future of development in that particular state and more broadly in post-reform India?
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. They both sound like great projects. We look forward to reading the fruits of those sometime soon. There's nothing more for me to do apart from to thank you very much for coming on New Books in South Asian Studies. It's been a real pleasure to talk with you about your book today.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening to the New Books in South Asian Studies podcast. I've been your host, Ian Cook, and today we've been talking about Reengineering India by Carol Upadhyay. I really hope you enjoyed our discussion today. I absolutely loved the book and I really enjoyed speaking with Carol, and I hope you're going to listen again next time. Ta-ra!